Today we're going to talk about the biggest question of the greatest importance to begin with. I mean, it's just the biggest question we can ask at the very beginning of all questions, and that is does God exist? The writers of the Bible don't make arguments for the existence of God because they believe that it, and I believe that it's so obvious that that as Paul says in Romans 1, verse 20, people are without excuse because what we see in creation, it makes it so obvious that God is actually there. And people in the ancient world in general didn't deny the existence of God. In fact, they multiplied. They had gods and goddesses. They were confused about it, but they didn't deny the existence. But today, people do, and I want to contend that even though the Bible doesn't make arguments for the existence of God, it assumes it, and in the way it assumes it, we pick up on some other reasons I think besides just the fact that nature makes it obvious. How does nature make it obvious? And we'll be looking at some of that today. We'll begin with Genesis chapter 1, which we heard earlier. Notice again that just the first two verses. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. The Bible says that before the beginning there was God, and at the very beginning of all things, God was the one who was responsible for creating all that is. Every effect has a cause. What I mean by that is this building. This building is here because somebody built it. And the things that are in this building, the Bible that you may have in your hands or had earlier in your hands earlier today, didn't just drop down out of nowhere. It came from somewhere. And we ourselves came from somewhere. We came from our parents, and they came from their parents, and their parents, and their parents, and their parents. But what happens when you get back to a point where there are no more parents? What happens when you get back to the point where we can go as far as we can possibly go in where all these materials came from, where the wood came from, where the bricks came from, where the metal came from? What if you go back as far as you possibly can? Then what? The Christian response to that has always been, then you have God. Sometimes people ask, where did God come from? But that misses the point. God, by his very nature, is beyond and outside of time and space. But we're talking about what's in time and space. And we get to a certain point where we can't go any farther. The universe is not eternal. At one point, there were people who tried to argue that the universe was eternal, but that argument didn't work out so well. And today, the scientists in general would agree that the universe is running down. Second law of thermodynamics, that energy, in effect, is being expended and it's running down. Well, running down from where? If it's not eternal, there's some point at which it started running down. And at that point, where do you go at that point? And some people just sort of ignore the question, but there was an author by the name of Robert Jastrow who wrote a book a number of years ago called God and the Astronomers. Now, it's important to know something about Jastrow. Jastrow is an astronomer, authority on life in the universe, founder of NASA's Goddard Institute for Science Studies, and an agnostic. So as an agnostic, Jastrow says, I don't know if God exists or not. At one point, I think he may have said, and nobody does, but then he decided just he didn't. And both of those are agnosticism. But in his book, God and the Astronomers, he's gone through all this. He's gone through all this evidence having to do with the universe, and he finally comes to a place where he says, "Now we would like to pursue that inquiry farther back in time, and that is where everything came from originally. But the barrier to further progress seems insurmountable. It is not a matter of another year, another decade of work, another measurement, or another theory. At this moment, it seems as though science will never be able to raise the curtain on the mystery of creation." And then he writes, "For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries." What he's saying is, if left to purely scientific means, we are never going to discover the beginning of the universe. So what's the answer? And he says, well, as an agnostic, maybe the answer is what all these religious folks have been saying for all these years, that God exists and that he is the one who started everything. In the Middle Ages, Thomas Aquinas said that he spoke of an unmoved mover, an uncaused first cause, a necessary being. What he's saying is that before the universe began, there was God. He's the one who caused it all to start. He's the one necessary being. We are not necessary. I know that's hard to believe. I mean, I'm very necessary to me, but I'm not very necessary to the whole being of the universe. And as I said, I'm contingent. I'm contingent on my parents, on their parents, on their parents before them. But Aquinas was saying, but there is a being, God, who didn't have any cause. He is the cause, but he didn't have a cause. Something like in Exodus 3 when God is revealing himself to Moses, and Moses asks, who am I supposed to tell the Israelites sent me? And God said, I am. I am. It was his way of saying, always am, always will be. The book of Revelation says something like that in more than one place, but one of them is chapter 4, verse 11, where God is called the one who was and is to come. He always has been. Revelation also calls him the Alpha and the Omega. He's the beginning and the end, and he's everything in between. He is the eternal one. That has been the biblical answer, and it makes sense. The universe didn't cause itself. Unless it's eternal, which almost no one would argue that anymore, it needs a cause. And there is no cause that anyone has come up with that makes any sense whatsoever without having a beginning point for everything that is. But not only that, but life needs a cause. Life doesn't come from non-life. And yet, that's what evolutionists and atheists, that's exactly what they have to argue. I remember reading a science textbook. Oh, it was absolutely delightful. I remember at the beginning of the book, it pictured a sunny riverbank, a bit of matter, just the right combination of chemicals, and poof, life began. I've read fairy tales that weren't any better than that. What it's saying is life came from non-life. But that was disproved a long time ago. You know, there was a time when people believed that maggots spontaneously generated from garbage, and that rats spontaneously generated from trash. I don't know if anybody believes any of that anymore. So why would we believe that life, somehow, life in the universe just appeared out of nowhere? I mean, it didn't have a, there was no life before it, and all of a sudden there's life out of non-life. There was a number of years ago, there were two British men. One was a theologian, the other one a scientist. And they were discussing the beginning of the universe and all that. And the scientist said, well, with all the planets in the universe, there was bound to be life on one of them. And the theologian said, well, suppose the police found a dead body in your Saratoga trunk. And you said, with all the Saratoga trunks that there are in the world, there was bound to be a dead body in one of them. The police would still wonder why there's one in yours. And we have to wonder, where did life come from? If life really doesn't come from non-life, then where did this life come from? Also, intelligence. Intelligence doesn't come from non-intelligence. We don't expect skyscrapers to be built by tornadoes or watches to be created by hurricanes. John Gerstner wrote, there is a kind of life which not only lives, but which thinks about living. There is a life turning in on itself, studying itself, defining itself, conscious of itself. We are such life ourselves. I mean, think about how profound it is that we think about our lives, that we study life, that we define life and we define self. We're conscious. We're not simply responding to stimulus, but we are thinking, intelligent creatures coming and believing that somehow intelligence just came, again, like life in general, just came poof from nowhere, is incredible. So if you need an answer, which we do, to how did it all begin, God's the answer. But a second argument, and this is the one that I think is most popular and most persuasive to most people. It has been in the past and still is today, an argument from order and design. In Psalm 19, notice verses 1 through 4. The heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. The psalmist is saying that the very heavens, in other words, the very universe around us, declares the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. And creation is constantly speaking of the glory of God, the existence and the glory of God. But, and part of the way that it does that is through order and design. I mean, if you find the most simple, well, no, I'll use it this way. Suppose you were shipwrecked on an island, and you're investigating the island, and you find this thing. There's a stick, a sturdy stick, and on the end of it there is an oblong-shaped stone that's been strapped to the stick by vines. What's your first thought? Is your first thought, what an interesting thing to grow here? No, it's probably who made it. And the second one is he still around? Why? Because the axe shows design, and not a design that we would simply find in nature. Now, why is it that we can see a simple thing like a stone axe, and say, oh, there's purpose and design, someone must have designed it, but we can look at the wonderful design in the world around us and not ask the same question. William Paley, many years ago, used the illustration of a watch. He said, if you've got a watch, we look at that and we know that it was designed. There's order to it, there's design. And when you look at the universe, you see the same kind of precision in the universe. There's order in the and design. And just as we know that someone made the watch, it didn't just come together as some kind of chance combination of materials. When we look at the universe, we see the same thing. Or I think about Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin was one of the founding fathers of the U.S. At one point, Benjamin Franklin was ambassador to France. And in France, he really flew in some of the highest literary and scientific circles, and he was in a particular elite literary and scientific club. And it became very popular at that point in French history to be skeptical among the elite. And so they were skeptical about all things having to do with religion and with God, and it became very popular there to deny the existence of God altogether. One day it was said, Franklin came into a meeting of the scientific group, and he brought with him a scale model of the universe, or not, of the solar system, not the universe, the solar system. And it had the sun, and it had the different planets, and they were positioned the way it would be, and they were the right size, and it was quite a marvel. And one of the men in the organization was looking at this marvelous creation, and he said, who made it? And Franklin said, no one. It just happened. Again, why could we look at a model of the solar system and say, who made it, and not look at the solar system itself and not ask the same question, who made it? The order and the design of the universe is all around us. And again, it is something that has been persuasive and still is. There are a number of scientists today who have come to faith, and philosophers and scientists both, who say there's order in the universe. There's design in the universe. I can't deny the order and the design. And my conclusion is that God has to exist in order for what I see to exist. And a number of years ago, in the 40s and 50s, there was a man by the name of Whitaker Chambers. Whitaker Chambers had been a communist, and actually a communist spy for the Soviet Union against the United States. And he was also, being a good communist, was an atheist. And then it appeared overnight he switched sides. And when you read his book called Witness, you find out where the switch came from. He had gotten married and he had a daughter. And he said one day his daughter was in her high chair and she was meditatively dropping food on the floor. And he was watching this most wonderful, beautiful creature. And he got to noticing the delicate curves of her ear. And in an involuntary way, he thought, this didn't just happen. This is designed. And it was the beginning of his journey that moved first from atheism to faith, and then in faith to reject the communist philosophy, which is bound up with atheism. Also, if you just think about, we can think about so many things. The design of the universe is all around us. I was in marvelous and sometimes subtle ways. This morning, I noticed there's a ladybug up here. I love ladybugs. My daughter and I share a love for ladybugs. The little predators. Did you know most ladybugs are predators? We think of them little sweet things, except the fiery orange ones that will bite you. I don't like those. But the little red ones, the vast majority of ladybugs are predators. But they feed on things that feed on your garden. Not just things in general, but what feed on your garden. Their favorite food is the aphid. And if you raise roses, you know the aphid is like the number one enemy of roses. But ladybugs have been called the gardener's best friend. Natural way of controlling bugs in your garden. They don't just eat aphids, but they eat the other things too. You might call them terminators or exterminators. But they deal with other creatures. So we think of reaching for their chemicals when maybe we just need to reach for a little bag of ladybugs. But you see, that's just part of the design and the balance in the universe. Or the Earth itself. The Earth itself is an absolutely marvelous picture of design and order. And without going into too much detail on this, the Earth is in just the right kind of galaxy. There are different kinds of galaxies. And only 1% of them could sustain life as we know it. And we're in just the right galaxy. Figure that. We're in the right place in the galaxy. We have the right kind of star. Our sun is the right kind of sun because there are different kinds of suns. And some of them, there would never be life. We're the right distance from the sun. You realize if we were just a little closer to the sun, we'd all burn up. And if we were just a little farther away, we'd all freeze. Our planet is the right size itself and has the right mass to it. It spins in the right way. It has the right tilt. There are bigger planets in our solar system that actually protect the Earth from meteors. There's no black hole around to swallow us up. We have a large single moon, which is important to have to have life on planet Earth. The magnetic field that we have on Earth is just right. If it were different, life wouldn't be here. We can go on and on and on and on, and each of those factors within itself is marvelous, but when you put them all together, Earth is an absolutely incredible place. An accident? Sometimes people bring up, well, there must be life somewhere else and whatever. My opinion is that there's not, but I agree with Marshall Keeble who was asked if he believed there was life on the moon, and he said, no, but if there is, I'll preach to it. My faith will not be shaken whatsoever if there's life somewhere else in the universe. I don't believe there is, but if there is, it still wouldn't be shaken. But what we do know is that this planet that we are on and this life we experience here is unique and shows order and design. One more argument. I'll call this the moral argument. In Romans, well, while you're turning there, I'll also say the Bible throughout proclaims that God exists and that his will, his view of the way people should treat each other and of morality is the will, is the view, is right. And everything else is judged by that. So God gives commands, and he doesn't just give commands arbitrarily. It's part of the very nature of the universe because it's part of the nature of God. And so there is a standard of right and wrong. And whether we are right or wrong, whether we are good or bad, depends on how we live in order in relationship to the standard. In Romans chapter 2, notice verses 14 and 15. And in context here, he has been talking about Gentiles who are in sin in chapter 1, who have been in rebellion to God. And then in chapter 2, he tells the Jews, you have the law and all that, but you don't keep it, so you're not any better off. And then he's got an interesting, it's kind of an aside. in verses 14 and 15. Indeed, when Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature the things required by the law, they are a law for themselves, even though they do not have the law, since they show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts also now accusing and now defending them. What's he saying? He's saying the law was given to Israel. Israel was supposed to live by the law and didn't do a very good job of it. Most Gentiles didn't do a very good job of it either. But he said, but some Gentiles, even though they didn't have the law, by nature they did the things in the law. They had a sense of right and wrong, even though they didn't hear the specific law. Now, the point I would like to make is that if there is, truly is right and wrong, and it's not just an opinion, then that says there's got to be a standard for right and wrong. And if there's a standard, a universal set standard for right and wrong, then there has to be a lawgiver, a standard giver. People in general do have a feeling of ought. I'm not saying it's the same everywhere, but there is a sense of ought or should. For instance, how would you like it if somebody did that to you? So, why would that make any difference to me? Because there's a should. You should think in a certain way. Or, that's my seat, I was there first. So? Okay, but there's a sense that it ought to be in a certain way. Or, come on, you promised. Well, why is it making a difference if I promised? So people people have this sense of ought, and it doesn't really work like somebody wakes up one morning and thinks, oh, I ought to have a sense of ought. No, it's ingrained in us. And again, the sense of ought may be warped. What people think ought to be or should be maybe will differ from each other, but just the principle that there's something beyond me. Now, this isn't a popular idea today. What's popular today is that it's all relative. It doesn't matter. But I find that we use that sort of conveniently. It's relative in matters where I want it to be relative, and it's not relative in matters where I don't want it to be relative. Are you following me? Certain things that I believe are wrong, it's not relative. It's not relative at all. But in areas where I want a pass, then I start talking about it being relative. But it either is relative or it's not relative. If we go with it's relative, actually, we are making the argument of Nazi war criminals following World War II. Following World War II, during the Nuremberg trials, one of the arguments that the Nazis made was, this court has no jurisdiction over us whatsoever, and your laws have no jurisdiction over us. We lived under the law of Germany at that time, and what we did was perfectly legal. You have no right from the outside to impose your law on us. Now, if it's all relative, they've got a pretty good argument, don't they? It's all relative. You had your law, we had ours. Why are you judging us by yours? The response of the justices of the court was, there is a higher law than the law of nations, and you violated that, and that's what you're being tried on. I don't know how many justices would make that argument today. That's saying there is a higher standard, there is a set standard that has nothing to do with nations. Relativity, by the way, I think took a blow at 9/11, because before that it was very, very popular to talk about how relative it was, but since then, as I said, it's become sort of selective. When we see certain terrible things going on in the world, we know they're terrible. And it's not just my opinion or the opinion of my society. It really is true. If there is no objective truth, then feeding the nations or exterminating them are all the same. the thieves who beat up the guy on the road to between Jerusalem and Jericho, the thieves who beat him up, the priest and the Levite who just left him there in the ditch, and the Samaritan who took care of him are all the same, if it's all relative. If you were walking down a road, and you heard a baby crying, and you looked over in the ditch and saw a baby there by itself crying, you would then have a choice, right? You could go to the baby, pick up the baby, take it to the authorities, take it home, take it to a hospital, whatever is necessary. You could ignore the baby crying. It's not my business. I'll go on. Or you could take a rock and beat his head in. Now, is one of those better than the others? If it's all relative, then one's not better than the other. But if there is a standard beyond us, then caring for the baby, and we know that. We know that. That caring for the baby is an infinitely better choice than the other two. But that implies a standard. There was once a debate between a philosopher, Roman Catholic priest, philosopher by the name of Copleston, and an atheist or agnostic. He seemed to morph between the two of them, but anyway, he was an atheist or an agnostic at this point by the name of Bertrand Russell. And in the debate, in my view, and I think in the view of others who've read the debate, Copleston won with one single question. He asked Bertrand Russell if the Nazis exterminating 6 million Jews was objectively wrong. And Russell had no answer. If he'd said it's objectively wrong, then he lost the debate because he's just admitted an objective standard and God. But on the other hand, he couldn't bring himself to say it wasn't wrong. How do you answer that question? Well, there is no good answer except that there is an objective standard, and that God is the giver of the objective standard. I think today people really need to be pressed on this, and we as believers need to very much hold on to this, because what I'm finding today is more and more and more people are saying, well, you know, all that stuff in the Bible about morality, that was from back then. But this is now. Okay? What's that got to do with it? If God revealed what was back then, then what was back then is still true today. There's the issue. Did the unmoved mover, did the Creator God reveal a standard? If he revealed a standard, then it's as true in one age as it is in another. It's not just left up to us to make our best stab at it in any particular age, but it's a matter of living to the standard. A number of years ago, the famous atheist Madeline Murray O'Hare received a letter from a young atheist who was struggling with whether he should tell his parents that he was an atheist. They wouldn't have liked the idea. She wrote back to him and told him that he should tell his parents because, listen to her words, quote, "You have to be honest, Mark, and to use your own mind," unquote. Why? Why? Why must he be honest? Why must he use his own mind? Why? It's all relative. But it's not. And so as hard as people try to escape it, they keep coming back to it. And, you know, you put all this together. Where'd the universe come from? Why is there design here? Why is there a sense of right and wrong, and that some people do better than others? Why is it that we know? I mean, we know, and this isn't just our opinion. We know that that people who save life are doing better than people who murder. We know that. We know that people who are generous and give are doing better than people who are selfish and steal. That's not just our opinion. It comes from God Himself. Would you bow with me for a prayer? Our Father in heaven, we thank you. We thank you that you have revealed yourself to us in so many ways, that you have shown yourself to us as the great, awesome, eternal Creator. And Father, help us in each day, in every way, to surrender our lives to you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.